Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 227 for January 31st. Watch out! Bob Lutz is now a watchmaker. Watch Auto Line After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. I want to thank everybody joining us tonight. Especially want to thank Gary Vasilash from Automotive Design and Production Magazine to be here.
You good?
Always good to have you, Gary.
Thank you.
And we got something of an announcement to make now, too, because Gary, as of this show, is officially my co-host on After Hours. And you've been somebody who's been on the show an awful lot, and it's great to have you part of the program now.
I appreciate the opportunity. Should be fun.
Yeah. Also, I have Todd Lassa from Automobile Magazine. Todd, great having you here.
John, always good to be here.
Yeah, and we'll get into what you guys have been into in a minute, but we got to introduce our special guest for today's show, Bob Lutz. And let's see, Bob, I've got several titles for you here. CEO of Lutz Communications.
That's correct, yeah.
Chairman of VL Automotive.
Right.
And former vice chairman of General Motors.
That's correct.
There's a whole bunch of
all of those are right, yeah.
Too, but. And we'll get into some of that a little bit later of what you're into right now. But
I think he's sort of like Elvis. I mean, all you had to do is say Lutz, and everybody knows, and it's just.
Have you been spotted in any, you know, convenience stores in Arizona recently?
Oh, Kalamazoo. That's where
Kalamazoo, right, yeah. Okay.
Elvis supposedly had disappeared, too. Gary, you've been doing what this week? What's caught your attention?
I just got back today from Phoenix, driving the new GM heavy-duty pickup trucks. And Jeff Luke, who was on the show a couple months ago with the light-duty, he was out there for the heavy-duty, the diesel-powered GMC and Chevy. And? Very impressive trucks. I mean, they did a hell of a job.
You're just saying that because Bob Lutz.
No, I mean, essentially, I mean, okay, if you look at the light duty trucks, right? So they did a whole new architecture in 2011, and they built on that. Okay, so we saw with the new one, you know, the new cab. So that's been taken over, and it's being used for the heavy duty. They've taken the architecture, the design that was developed in 2011, and they've beefed it up to make a heavy-duty vehicle out of it. And you know, they've just added some really nice amenities to a category which I think is going to become increasingly important. And I was pretty surprised to learn that one out of four pickups sold in the United States is a heavy-duty.
And you think that's going to go up? You think
if you define heavy duty as 250 or over,
right?
Yeah,
and so yeah, I mean because you know we also saw that announcement that Ford just came out with about adding to the Kentucky truck plant where they're going to be investing $80 million in adding 350 jobs in Kentucky. Now I think there's maybe something else going on there because I mean if you think about it that. The Super Duty, you know, the heavy duty version of the F series truck, mm-hmm. You know, that probably the new version isn't going to come out for a couple of years, probably, right? So let's just say that
those I think are going to remain steel.
Right, that's my point.
Yeah.
So if you have some doubters, right, that are going to say, "Gee whiz, I don't know that I want to buy one of these aluminum things."
Yeah, that's really where the bet on aluminum isn't as big as everybody suspected because it's really only I'm surmising it's only the light duty 150s that get the aluminum.
Yeah, for now.
Certainly
but then
for now.
The big SUVs will go that way in a couple of years.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's, I mean, the weight challenge is everywhere.
It's going to be, you know, I'm not, I have to admit, I'm not much of a truck guy. It's just a tool as far as I'm concerned. I'm the lower. The longer and wider the car, the better. The lower the car, it doesn't matter how long and wide it is. But, you know, it's going to be a fascinating two or three years with pickup trucks, what with General Motors' kind of short-term response, at least, being, well, we've got these new mid-sized trucks. We've decided to stay in this category. Those trucks are almost like a downsizing of the full-size trucks, because the full-size trucks over the years have gotten inched up in size, and they now feel, you get into them and you almost feel like you're in heavy duty sometimes.
For the light duty trucks.
For the half-ton full-size and F-150, a Chevy Silverado, whatever. So now you've got GM saying, well, we'll tackle the cafe needs and going after that, the aluminum truck segment with our Chevy Colorado and our GMC Canyon, although they lose out on the whole footprint thing that makes it so easy.
That's really an interesting experiment.
Yeah. Because
the big question in my mind, and it always has been, is will the Colorado and Canyon expand GM's market share and draw sales from Ram and Ford, or will they predominantly cannibalize Silverados and Sierras?
Or will they just sell kind of well for the first year and then kind of settle down to where mid-sized trucks have been?
I will say, you know, I've driven it. The truck was originally designed in Brazil, so I've driven it a lot. It's been upgraded to U.S. specs and with an all new front end sheet metal and so forth, and it's a much beefier looking truck than the original Brazilian one was. But it is fundamentally a good truck,
right? But isn't the thing that they're trying to address that Toyota and Nissan basically are walking away with that market? And,
well, there is a big market there, and the existing Colorado and Canyon had a 7-year gestation because it was originally going to be a joint product with Suzuki. Isuzu.
Yeah.
And there was so much wrangling between the Isuzu engineers and the GM engineers that the Isuzu guys finally said, well, we're going to do ours and we're not going to wait for you. So theirs came out first. And then our version came out about 3 years later. And the styling was literally 5 years old when the truck hit the road.
Mm-hmm.
But the new one should do much better. I think all of it depends on what is the price step from the Colorado and Canyon to the Silverado.
Sure.
And then the question too is,
what's going to be in the
got to be enough of a gap to where people will say, well, okay, I'll settle for the small one. If the gap is $800, people will say,
I'm not going to see it on the car payment.
You know, for another $10 a month, I'll take the big one.
But you know, and how much of that gap are they going to fill with the diesel engine, which obviously is a fairly big part of that strategy too? It comes out a year after the new Colorado and Canyon. Did you get a chance to drive that?
I have never driven a diesel Colorado.
Okay.
But I imagine it'll probably get mileage in, you know, sort of the low 30s highway.
Yeah.
But diesel engines are expensive, and they're getting more expensive by the minute. I mean, it's a diesel is, based on the cost picture that I know, if you have your choice between going an aluminum body or going a diesel drivetrain, for the same cafe result, going aluminum is going to cost you a lot less than going diesel. Diesel engines now are, you know, they're in the $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 with the necessary emission system.
The thing I'd have to worry about with aluminum more so than the cost to Ford, which, you know, the margins generally are so good on pickup trucks anyway,
yeah.
So they'll have a much smaller margin, and they've already kind of warned Wall Street that the profits aren't going to be very good this year.
Yeah, but the profits are not going to be because of the aluminum. It's because they're going to lose 13 weeks of production on the F-Series. That's why.
But the aluminum will have something to do. I mean, they've all new tooling and everything.
You need new tooling for a new truck anyway.
I wouldn't be surprised to see a launch that is not totally without difficulties.
Well, and then...
Because you're dealing with a brand new material, and it's different when you're just doing Cadillac hoods and deck lids,
right?
Because those are very flat surfaces and they're easy to stamp and everything. But once you start doing convoluted panels where you have to join the inner and the outer and they have to be attached to other panels, now it becomes more difficult. Now you're going to have to start doing riveting and...
Sure, and you got the assembly process.
And structural adhesives and stuff like that. which is not the traditional Detroit way of putting stuff together.
And they have to, the all new process of manufacturing, so they have to train these guys too. Yeah. And then the question for me has been, you don't throw building materials in the trunk of a Cadillac. I mean, what are the repair costs going to be? Ford has already said it's going to help its dealers deal with the cost
that
of the.
Lally and his guys are smart enough that they figured that out.
No
and
question.
I would bet you that if they determined that aluminum was insufficiently rigid for the bed, which gets abused more than any other part of a pickup, they may well do a special hard aluminum alloy or even steel the box inner. And the lift gate very definitely cannot be made out of aluminum, because that's the one where the good old boys just dump the log on the lift gate and let it bounce off. And you see so many steel lift gates that are V-shaped. You know?
Right. I have no doubt that Mulally and his people have figured out the way to make this the most cost-effective way it can be, but I can't imagine that that you're going to have the same profit margin per truck going forward on the 2015 F-150.
On the Corvette, the normal industry practice for years was you pay a dollar for a pound saved, but you don't pay more than a dollar for a pound saved. And that led to people selecting cast iron blocks, cast iron heads, cast iron transmission cases, cast iron diffs and everything, because it was cheaper. But everything gets heavier. So now you need a bigger engine, a bigger transmission, bigger brakes. So you're into this vicious cycle of mass begetting more mass. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're willing to invest in lightweighting, you're into a virtuous cycle. As the mass comes out, you can use a smaller engine, lighter transmission, smaller brakes, a less expensive power steering setup, and so forth. And everything goes in the right direction. And with the C6 Corvette that was done by Dave Hill, they used the rule $7 for a pound saved. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, the Corvette met its cost objectives. And what I always tell the bean counters when they say, oh, no, it's a dollar per pound. So you wind up with a vehicle that's 600 pounds too heavy. But it's every single decision you made, you pick the low cost solution. Heavier but low cost. Now, are you going to tell me at the end of the day that 600 pounds of glass, chrome, paint, and plastic and steel is free? So I think if you pursue, and I'm convinced that the way they've figured that out, and with the price they paid for aluminum, and with low energy, aluminum cost is predominantly energy cost. Now, with the cheap energy we've got in the U.S., where we're paying a quarter as much for industrial natural gas as any other country, I would say that and with the buy that Ford made, I wouldn't be surprised if they come out only slightly higher than steel.
I looked it up, though. Now, this is spot market. This mm-hmm. isn't buying multi-year contracts and getting discounts.
Which Ford did, of course.
So a roll of hot-rolled carbon steel is roughly $700 a ton. Mm-hmm. A roll of aluminum is about $1,700, $1,000 more per ton. So it will add cost. Yeah,
but you get so much more sheet metal per ton.
Is that right?
Well, it's not going to be ton for ton, obviously.
If it costs half as much, a ton is going to give you twice as much sheet metal as a ton of steel.
The argument, though, that the steel guys make is that you actually need thicker gauge aluminum to get the same performance. Yeah. So it's not a one to one.
The real answer is, and I have to disclose that I'm a board member, but it's NanoSteel. A startup company that is partially financed by General Motors was working on a steel formulation that approaches aluminum in weight but maintains all of the properties of steel. And that's the ultimate solution, because the car business loves steel. It's easy to stamp. easy to weld, easy to process. Everybody knows its characteristics. So ultimately, I think the big menace to aluminum is lightweight steels.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
But isn't the biggest challenge to Ford not so much just the fact they're using aluminum, but as you were alluding to, you know, you've got the problem that you've got a new product, right? It's a new vehicle, and new vehicle launches can be difficult. But now you've got new process because, as you point out, it doesn't process just like steel does, whether we're stamping it, welding it, you know, assembling it otherwise. You've got that. You know, so new product, new process, new material, new plant, you know.
Well,
And the volume of the F-Series. Yeah. This isn't like
exactly.
They're doing...
It's not a 20,000 unit
right.
Corvette.
I mean, it's just like, why...
I told Mullally, I said, I think this is the bravest thing I've ever seen anybody do in the automobile business, because if my guys had come to me and said, let's do an aluminum, I would have said, why don't we start with the Camaro or something?
It's incredibly brave, and if this works the way it should, it will be a great move for Ford in terms of getting its largest volume vehicle into that reverse of the weight spiral.
Yeah, they call it the virtuous cycle.
Yeah, to take 700 pounds out of that truck is incredible, but we worry a little bit about Chrysler airflow effect
here. That's where Mark Royce says, I can't wait to get my hands on one, because what he means is teardown, mm-hmm. and find out where the 700 pounds is.
Right.
Because up to now, Silverados have been roughly 250 to 300 pounds lighter than an F-150. So now they're about 250 to 300 pounds below a Silverado. But the question is that all due to the aluminum, or did they follow a lot of the engineering practices that are in a Silverado that just generally work towards mass reduction, even with steel?
Or even some of the principles we've seen displayed, shown to us about the Cadillac ATS and CTS, you know, smarter.
Focused like lightweighting without excessive use of exotic materials.
It's a good way to go. My question, though, is, you know, we were talking earlier, you know, gasoline prices are coming way down. All these CAFE regulations were predicated on peak oil driving up the price of oil and gasoline. What happens if that never happens?
I think CAFE regulations were, it was energy independence. And now I think even with the plentiful gas and oil that we've got in the United States and prices coming down and almost facing a glut of liquid petrochemicals, I think now it's totally a part of the environmental climate change agenda. Mm-hmm.
Well, but you can't ignore the way gasoline prices, oil prices fluctuate so much, and that just the way the market is controlled. And I understand that we've found a lot more. We're now exporting more than we're importing.
But the key here, Todd, is that they've come up with a new way of drilling.
Yeah.
Horizontal drilling coupled with fracking. Mm-hmm. And largely, so far, only the United States has done this. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of other countries that are very keen on adopting this. The UK is getting into it. Argentina, China's even looking at it. So we're talking about, boy, peak oil's over just because the U.S. has done all this. Wait till the rest of the world gets into these new drilling techniques.
Right, but don't forget that, you know,
As their demand goes up, though, too.
But
yeah, demand will go.
But, I mean, as Bob was alluding to, I mean, this is, let's not forget the environmental part of this, because let's say that just tonight they announced that, you know, 2025, it's off the table. We got a lot of oil. We're not going to worry about that. But the European Union, you still have the 95 grams per kilometer for CO2.
Which is just MPG.
But
it's the reverse.
Right, but basically, so burning more fuel because the fuel is available means that you're not going to hit that mark. Therefore, if you're BMW, you're going to be concerned with making that mark, right?
And if it comes off in the United States but not in Europe.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't.
And also in China.
The CAFE rules would have to be scrapped globally, and that's just not going to happen.
And it's not going to happen.
And what you've got, there would be resistance from the industry itself now, because the industry would say, we have spent tens of billions of dollars on the technology to make this possible. If you look at our forward plan for the next 6 years, it's all based on compliance. And then you've got all these supplier companies that are developing all of the enablers to meet the future fuel economy requirements, and you'd be pulling the rug out from under those. So we've really kind of tipped the whole motivation of the automobile industry and its supply base towards CAFE compliance, and dropping it now would meet with a lot of resistance.
Well, and to be fair, and I've always agreed with you on the CAFE versus a gas tax issue. Yeah. But to be fair, this has also driven some great technology. We now have cylinder shutoff in Corvettes. We now have four cylinder diesels powering rear wheel drive Mercedes E classes, and we have four cylinder engines making horsepower that
the justification
V8s made when I was getting my driver's license.
The justification for putting all this technology in is because we thought gas prices were going to go up so high, you were going to get that payback. Now that payback doesn't look like it's going to happen.
Well, the concern on the part of the manufacturers always was that CAFE cars would put the industry at war with its customers, and that the customer at $2.90 a gallon is going to say, I'll have the V8, please. And the bet was that with $6 a gallon, most people would buy a V6 Mustang or a V4 or a V6 Camaro, and maybe the new Mustang
at some four, yeah.
Yeah, well, and you know why not? But at $2.90 a gallon or $2.95 a gallon, inflation adjusted, it's now at almost historic lows. And here's a government that is desperate for revenue. Now would be the time. You know, I'm going to get another billion hate
don't
emails.
Don't go there, Bob.
Yeah, don't say it, but I'm going to say it anyway. I'm used to it. But if ever there was a right time to put on a federal 25 cents a gallon tax, this is it.
I don't think they'd be marching on Washington with torches.
I wish there was ever a right time, but the Tea Party would become the oil party.
To go from $3, which it is now, to $3.25. Yeah, well, who would notice it?
Some people would. Yeah, believe me, I agree with you, but tax is a four-letter word.
Every other country in the world has done it, but in the United States, it's a political impossibility.
Yeah.
Okay, changing topics here slightly. Gary, I know you just got back from driving the new Volvo V60, and mm-hmm. what I'm more curious about is not so much the car, but the company. Volvo's been in a herd of trouble here. Can they come back?
Well, it was very interesting. Volvo, independent company owned by Volvo Group. Volvo Group sells the car part of the business to Ford. Ford is then trying to engage Volvo, providing engines and so on and so forth. And then Ford decides, we've gotten rid of Aston Martin, we've got rid of Jaguar Land Rover, and let's get rid of Volvo. So Geely, the Chinese company, buys Volvo.
For a bargain.
In 2010, I believe.
Yeah, it was the last of the PAG to be sold off.
Right, it was the last one to go. Yeah. So, I had the sense that perhaps this was going to be less of a Scandinavian company, that it was going to be more of a Chinese company, and that there would be some sort of presence. And the people that I talked to, they are happier the way it is now than it was when they were owned by Ford. And they were saying, because basically, from what it sounds is that Geely has said, okay, here's $11 billion. Okay, now it's your ass. And you better do it right, because if you fail, we're done with this. So the whole thing behind the new cars is the new powertrain. So what they did was, several years ago, they decided they needed to develop a new powertrain family. Now, they had been getting engines from Ford, but they wanted to develop their own. So they have this going forward, a four-cylinder strategy. So all their vehicles will have four cylinders. And they have a tremendous commonality between the diesel and the gasoline-powered engines. And, we're talking like 50% of the parts are like really common. 25% are absolutely common, and then the other 25% are pretty near. So you have this whole strategy going forward, and so it's now you have these engineers that are empowered to develop technology that they think is appropriate for their product. And those engines are really sweet. I mean, they're nice cars, and so I'm pretty optimistic about those guys. I mean, I they're still going to be a niche player. I mean, there's no question about that. And when I was reading your other book today, the earlier book, and you were mentioning about Saab, and
GM treated Saab much the way Geely did Volvo, with one difference. It was, here's the pile of money, and talk to us when you're out, and we'll talk about more, you know. So it was that second phrase, this is all you're getting, you better make it work, that speech was never given to him.
Mm-hmm.
So we suffered basically 20 years of writing multi-hundred million dollar checks every year.
But I wonder, from your point of view, do you think a company like Volvo, which would be, you know, comparatively, you know, it's a volume producer, but a very low volume producer
in a very expensive country to build cars.
But I mean, is it possible for
what's
a business case
now,
to be made?
300,000.
It might even be less.
I doubt they're even that high anymore. I don't know what the number.
You're talking globally, so you're talking about one assembly plant's worth of production with some overtime.
I'm talking globally. I thought they were considerably. See, Saab would have been all right if they had ever gotten to 250,000 units. But as I always said, there are only 90 to 110,000 liberal arts professors with a pipe and a tweed jacket and leather elbow patches in the world. And I mean, it's almost the point where somebody's, oh, my uncle owned a Saab. I said, oh, is he an academic? Yeah, how'd you know?
Or Kurt Vonnegut. Yeah.
And every time you tried to broaden the appeal, like with the last 9-3, then everybody would say, oh, the automotive journalist would say, well, that's not a Saab anymore. It's not weird enough.
Yeah, so how do you grow a quirky car company, right? That's the problem. How do you grow a quirky car company?
You're stuck in the quirky niche. And the minute you depart the quirky niche, everybody says, it's like, I always say, the clown at the back of the circus parade with the cart that's shoveling the elephant dung off the streets. Everybody says, oh, geez, I love that guy, and he wants a new job. Well, he's not going to get a new job because that's what they've got him assigned to. And every time we tried to make Saab something more and broaden the appeal, the global automotive press went nuts and said, we want that mascot. It's the kind of the cute, quirky car company, and you're not going to take it away from us.
And you got a lot of criticism for the way General Motors handled Saab by all, you know, everybody outside the company. And to me, if you look at the history of Saab, they always had to rely on another automaker.
They were never independent.
No.
I mean, first they belonged to the aviation company, and they had the old 90, you know, with the fastback load, right, with the three-cylinder two-stroke engine, which was probably leftover DKW technology.
Yeah.
And then that wouldn't meet emissions anymore, so then they used a Ford Cologne V4.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then came the Fiat era, where they had the 9000 was a version, same thing as the big Alphas and the big Fiats. It was common architecture. And then came the GM era. And I will tell you, without the use of the Opel Vectra architecture and without access to GM powertrains, Saab simply would not have existed. And I will tell you, the mistake that GM made was just kept pouring money on it and it would have made sense to consolidate purchasing. Never done. It would have made sense to consolidate engineering or design. Never done. It was just, let them exist up there, but now they had a financial donor, and that was perfectly okay with them.
Is there anything you suggested when you were there, or anything you wanted to happen that you think might?
I wanted to do, and we finally got it more or less done, but we consolidated the design studios, the amusing thing is the last 9-5. You know,
they look great.
It wasn't done by Swedes. It was done by Americans and Germans in the Rüsselsheim design studio. And everybody says, oh, now that GM, that's when Victor Miller The see now that GM is gone, they're back to building real Saabs. Those were all done by GM. Mm. And the same thing goes for ride handling, purchasing. I mean, I would have consolidated it and treated it as a brand. And you could still maintain brand distinction, but, you know, at 90 to 110,000 units a year and shipping high currency cars into a low currency country, which is the U.S., unless you priced like Mercedes and BMW, it didn't work. The reason relatively modest pricing works for BMW and Mercedes, I strongly suspect, is that they have a natural exchange rate offset. The more the dollar sinks, the more money they make on the U.S. assembled cars that go to Europe. And so at the end of the day, as long as the volume is about equal, the exchange rates balance out. It's what's called a natural hedge. Saab didn't have that. So Saabs, if we priced them where the market would accept them, there was no margin. If we priced them to where we made money, there were no sales.
So what's the minimum viable number for a car company to exist?
Well, it depends what end of the market they're in. You know, like my partner Gilbert Villarreal and I, who are doing
a nice step-in, by the way.
the VL Destino, which is a de-electrified Fisker Karma with a Corvette ZR1 drivetrain and an automatic transmission, will be around a $200,000 to $250,000 car, depending on options. And we are set up from an investment standpoint and a facility standpoint that we will make a very nice profit at 200 cars per year. But why is that? We have a finished body that we didn't have to invest in. We have a finished drivetrain that we didn't have to invest in. Our total investment is front and rear fascias and the mechanical and software changes necessary to marry these two finished. But if we'd had to start from scratch, we would have sunk $200 or $300 or $400 million into the venture. And then $200 or $300 a year definitely would not work. So it all depends what your upfront cost is.
Wait. Let's get more into this. But we got to take a quick break and let's dive more into this. So, Carmen, let's go to our good friends at Firestone.
There's only one car company in America that's never made a single car. And while you won't find Firestone cars on any showroom floor, they're out there, running better, faster, stronger, longer. No, we don't build cars. But make no mistake, Firestone is a car company. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
Okay, Todd, I was cutting you off there. So what was your question?
I just wonder, so you're talking about Fiskers that have already been built, right?
Oh, yeah, sure. Well,
so 200 a year,
well, both.
You have.
Well, both.
Well,
there's like, I think, 2,700 of them in the United States. Yeah. But Gilbert and I also bought a bunch of gliders from Fisker and pre-bankruptcy. Fisker didn't get batteries anyway because of A123's Chapter 11, so they were delighted to sell us finished cars with no battery and no electric motor.
Can you say how many of those you have?
I think we have 20. But we also have a very, very large number of people wanting their vehicles converted.
Uh-huh.
And if somebody brings us a Fisker Karma that's in good shape, we can do the conversion for half the price of a new car. And frankly, we would come out with exactly the same margin. And there's a great deal of interest. We're hearing from a lot of former Fisker dealers, or I guess current Fisker dealers. We'll see if they ever restart again. They have a whole bunch of customers who say, I've got a semi-electric car that I didn't buy for that reason. I bought it for the styling. I'm totally not interested in the fact that it's an extended range electric vehicle. I always wanted it with a V8. We're having dealers come to us. I think we took 10 orders for conversions at the Detroit Auto Show alone from one dealer.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And a great deal of interest in the Middle East. So I think the plan is, and for certification purposes, it's convenient for us we can get EPA and CARB certification more easily if we're an upfitter and modifier of customer cars that are already titled, so that we don't have to become a manufacturer of record. Mm-hmm. Becoming a manufacturer of record requires a lot more in terms of compliance, and that's going to take us probably another 8 to 9 months. But during that 8 to 9 months, we can live off of cars that were originally Karmas and upfit them with a Corvette V8. So I'm very optimistic. I think it's going to be successful.
So who's this guy you're doing it with?
Gilbert Villarreal is a son of Mexican fruit pickers in California who joined the Marine Corps to become a citizen, then worked for Boeing, saved all his money, bought some Mexican trim companies, consolidated them, sold them to a large trim supplier, then went to order a yacht, and now he had millions. He went to Seattle to order a yacht, and they said, well, it's going to take 3 years because you're way down the queue. He says, may I look at your factory, please? And he said, told the guy, you know, if Boeing built 747s the way you build yachts, they'd build one 747 a year. So long and the short of it, he became co-owner of the yacht company and is now an automotive parts supplier in Auburn Hills. And he and I are both car fanatics and watch fanatics. So we have a car company and a watch company.
You've got a watch company.
Yeah, it's called...
Talk about that.
Well, it's VL, stands for Villarreal and Lutz. And Gilbert, very kindly, because of the way the alphabet is, and in deference to me, said it should really be LV. And I said, well, we can't do that because of Louis Vuitton wouldn't like it. But this is a prototype of our chronograph, and it's a 24-jewel Swiss movement. But the watch is assembled in Michigan, in Auburn Hills.
But this has nothing to do with Shinola. That's also making
watches. No, Shinola is a fashion brand, and they use quartz movements, and they're very inexpensive. That's a 24-jewel, fully automatic Swiss movement.
So what led you guys to go into watches besides doing
Well, we're both watch fans, and we figured we can probably, between us, we can design and build some watches that people other than ourselves will want to own.
So buy a car, get a watch too, or I mean,
well, it's going to be synergy between the brands? It will also work the other way around: buy a watch and get a car, but it'll be a $200,000 watch. But actually, for buyers of VL Destinos, we can arrange for the watch to have the same serial number as the car, and you see that through the transparent crystal back or quartz back. Mm-hmm. You can see the X-Center, the self-winder. And if you buy a Destino, you get a picture of the Destino on this little swinging weight, which I forget the proper watch terminology. So at any rate, no, we're having fun. I hope we make money.
When are the watches coming out?
The other one, the so-called date wheel watch, is out, but in limited quantity. At this one is probably a couple of months away.
So where do people get them?
Sir? We have not yet set, and that's one of the things we have to do. We have to figure out a distribution scheme. Do we go high-end catalogs, or do we advertise in magazines like Rob Report and DuPont Registry or stuff like that? Do we go with a nationwide jewelry chain? We don't know yet. We're still figuring that out. But right now, there's a website called VL Productions, and VL Productions will take and fulfill watch orders.
So you guys are funding this yourselves?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, totally.
Because I meant to say, when you say you don't have a distribution center strategy yet, no banker would give you money if you didn't have that fixed.
No. And the thing is, Gilbert is a manufacturing genius. And Gilbert's theory is if we build it, they will come. Well, and I'm always explaining, that's right, Gilbert, but you know, you and I only have so many friends and relatives, and at some point, we're going to have to figure out a way to sell thousands of these.
But this is a high-end watch, so you're not talking.
It'll, no, it'll, it's right? The date wheel watch is roughly $2,000.
Yeah,
and the chronograph is 3,000. And at some point,
wearing a Seiko, by the way, it's nowhere near that level.
Well, that's all right. I mean, look, watches are like cars.
Yeah.
A 5-year-old Chevy Impala with a 4-cylinder engine will satisfy your transportation needs as well as a $350,000 Lamborghini or Rolls Royce. And a Corvette ZR1 is not going to get you to Chicago 1 second faster than a Toyota Prius if you stay anywhere near the speed limit. So at some point, it's all fashion. It's all, I want it. I don't need it. It's not going to do the job any better than a 50-buck Timex. But I want it, and I'll wear it, and I'll show it, and then it's, I have it and you don't, mm-hmm. which is what car ownership is all about.
Sure.
If it weren't, I have it and you don't, nobody would, if all high-end cars, all cars, had uniform front ends with no badging, that would be the death of Mercedes, BMW, Audi, Rolls-Royce, Bentley, et cetera, et cetera.
But you don't need to sell a lot of these, is my point.
The watches?
At that level, yeah. I mean,
no,
this is a small volume, limited production.
We don't have to be a large, well-known watch company. A couple of thousand a year will do us nicely.
Okay.
And because we set it all up for low investment, mm-hmm. just like with the car. So that if you have low investment going in, you have a low break-even point.
Then you were also involved in electric vehicles.
Yeah, and that's why I say this. I atone for the fact with the greenies love the fact, quote, love, unquote, the fact that I am taking a wonderful extended range electric vehicle, ripping out all the green stuff and putting in a Corvette power plant. But I atone for this sin by taking by being a board member of VIA Trucks, which is on the cusp of releasing for production Chevy Express vans and Silverado pickups with a 32 kilowatt hour battery. Lithium ion.
Which that's a lot of battery.
Yeah, it'll be good. I may be off on the... No, I think it is about 30, which will be good for 45 to 50 miles purely electrically. And then with the new generation small V6 driving the generator, same idea as the Volt, it'll have a range of another 300 or 400 miles. And the fleets, especially the city delivery fleets like FedEx and utility companies and so forth, Coca-Cola and so forth, are screaming for these things because they'll save, even at $3 a gallon, they'll save so much on fuel that it'll pay for the price difference of the truck, which will be substantial. I mean, clearly, these will be priced nowhere near the base trucks. But there's a good market for them, and we've got a beautiful manufacturing facility set up in Mexico, which is all ready to go with conveyors in place and everything. We have the supply arrangement with GM, and GM is giving as much support as they decently can to a company that they don't own. But it's all going well, and I think that's going to be a very successful venture. Ultimately, VIA's plan is to also sell some of these trucks. Well, ultimately, it'll go up into sport utilities. Which, once you've done the pickup truck and the van, you know, it's not a very big step. And those will be sold, first of all, to hotels, airport shuttles mm-hmm. for hotels. Because every time it isn't driving to the airport, it can be plugged in. So it'll basically never run on gasoline. And then the plan also is to offer 4x4 pickups because of the exportable power. People will be able to go on a hunting trip up north, and they can power everything at the campsite, you know, lights, portable refrigerator, electric blankets, you name it, can all be off that truck, which is sitting there at idle, putting out 115 or 240, whatever you want.
So, when will those be on sale?
Well, I'm only a board member, and I'm not an executive of the company. the The company lost about 9 months through the bankruptcy of A123. And now incorporating a new battery supplier, and that always takes time. You'd think, well, batteries are plug and play. No, they're not. Because not, unlike flashlight batteries, which are normed, they're all the same. They have the same characteristics. Lithium ion automotive packs do not. They discharge at different rates. They have different properties. They come on faster or slower from cold. I mean, it just myriad differences, even if the specs look the same. And that's what's being ironed out now. But the firm plan still is first delivery to first fleets in the first quarter of this year.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Right around the corner.
Yeah. Yeah, and the plan really calls for several thousand this year.
That's delivery. So how close are you to production at this point?
As I said, first quarter.
First quarter for production. Okay.
Yeah. And we're getting all the certification with CARB. There's one or two little issues that we still have to resolve. But basically, and the crash test, it performed at least as well as the GM equivalents. So we're going to be fully, it'll be a fully certified manufacturer.
So this is like the Volt technology, but it is not the Volt technology.
No, it can't possibly be. First of all, General Motors was not about to release the codes and the algorithms, which are, I would say, a computer code masterpiece. And it's still being refined. And GM is not about to share that with anybody. So VIA basically had to re-engineer all of the software to control the interaction between battery and the IC engine. And that takes a lot of time. And people think it's trivial, but it's not. It takes an enormous amount of time and engineering effort.
So how do you get the bodies from GM? Do they ship a glider to you, basically?
I think, I don't know where VIA is.
Probably not.
That.
You probably got to pull the engine. I mean, just to drive it off the assembly line.
Alone. Well, it's near the GM truck plant, but I'm not sure whether VIA at this point is still having to buy complete trucks and take the engines and transmissions out, but the ultimate agreement with GM does call for gliders.
Okay.
To avoid waste.
And where is the reconstituted Fisker production? Where's that happening? Is that also in Mexico? Or?
No, the reconstituted. First of all, there is no reconstituted Fisker production.
Well, I mean the
VL Destino.
VL Destino. Sorry.
That is in Auburn Hills, Michigan.
In Auburn Hills.
Do you have the tooling for the Carmen?
No, because right now we have an ample supply of complete cars and our 20 or 22 gliders that we have. And that'll keep us busy for a while. And then as the Fisker Chapter 11 thing, which was contentious and the first solution was rejected, so now the bidding is renewed between two Chinese companies. And we'll see who wins. But in either case, we would expect to get a continued supply of bodies. And Valmet is the stamper. I suppose Gilbert and I, once we see where the ownership of Fisker goes, post-Chapter 11 ownership of Fisker, we have a number of alternative plans for how we get the necessary supplies of bodies. And I imagine if Fisker production is never restarted, we'll go talk to Valmet and buy bodies in white.
Interesting.
What do you need?
So it's not a limited supply at this point.
We see that we can produce these for years to come at 500 to 600 a year. But for that, then we will have used up the supply of Fiskers in the marketplace.
Right.
And we would have to, then at that point, that's why we want to be a manufacturer of record. Because converting a Fisker is a wasteful way of doing it. First, you have to disassemble everything, and then you have to reassemble it. We'd much rather start with bodies in white and then procure the GM powertrain bits, procure the interiors from the interior supplier, et cetera, et cetera, and behave like a normal automobile company.
And you'll need those suppliers to keep building them while you're also also converting into
all those
cars.
Suppliers. Some of them have.
Otherwise, all that stuff will go away.
Some of them have been talked to, and others need more talking to.
I see. And not everybody's on board yet.
No, it may be that we have to duplicate some things, you know, have to retool certain items that have gone out of production. We'll see. But it's first we have to get in production with complete cars and sell 50 or 150 or 250 of those to drive some revenue, because right now it's Gilbert and my capital, and we're managing it very carefully to the point where in the building he's told the snow removal guy that don't shovel the north part of the lot anymore, just shovel the south half. it was $700 per removal job. He's just cut down to $350.
Mm-hmm. You need to bring in one of the electric trucks with a plow.
That's right. Hey, we're getting a lot of questions here from the audience. Why don't we move on to that right now? And Goggles Pisano, Bob, has a question for you. What do you think of Volkswagen's MQB platform strategy?
Well, as I understand it, it's not so much a platform strategy as it is a component-driven strategy. And to me, that sounds very intelligent, because a platform strategy or an architecture strategy like GM has it is limited in some ways, in that you take the Epsilon architecture, it can be made wider or narrower, shorter or longer, or by putting inserts in over the cowl, it can be made higher, like the Buick LaCrosse. So it's very versatile, but you still can't combine all of the powertrain options that you'd like. And then there's no interchangeability between the Epsilon architecture and the Delta architecture, which is Chevy Cruze and the little Buick. So I think the way I imagine the Volkswagen's Volkswagen component-driven strategy is they'll have a bunch of V6 or i4 engines that have pretty much universal applicability across all vehicle lines. And you know, most GM powertrains or Ford powertrains do too. But then I think they've got it to the point where they have basic, not whole architectures, but pieces of architectures that can be combined to create all new cars with all new drivetrains. And that sounds less limiting to me than an architecture or platform-based strategy.
You know, it's interesting hearing you say that, because almost 20 years ago, Francois Castaing told me, sharing platforms doesn't save you money. Sharing components saves you money.
Yeah. No, he's right.
And he was right a long time ago. Let's see. Will here says, does the VIA Motor Products have regenerative braking?
Oh, of course.
And Goat Rope goes on to say, Consumer Reports just gave glowing reports to the Chevy Impala and Dodge Durango. He says, you know, never seen them do that for domestic vehicles. What percent of the auto-buying public is influenced by Consumer Reports?
You know, that is an interesting question, and I've never been able to come up with a satisfactory answer to myself. Whenever something didn't sell at GM, the sales guy said, well, what do you expect? We got a lousy write-up from Consumer Reports. And I said, well, how many people really read? Are you kidding? Every household in America. And if Consumer Reports doesn't recommend it, you're not going to sell any. Well, in the meantime, all of us have seen a lot of vehicles with quality reputations that are not as they should be, sell a bazillion vehicles, and other vehicles that have been lauded by Consumer Reports, frankly, don't do very well. So, is it important to get it? Yes. Would you rather have it than not have it? Of course. But I just have never been able to answer that question to my own satisfaction, and I've never had I've never had the marketing people answer it to my satisfaction either.
Would you ever design and build a car to meet their specs, or would you design and build a car that people would desire?
Well, ideally you'd do both. And GM actually started doing both. But what we said was we're not going to compromise the eye appeal and the characteristics that please the public and make the car a hot selling proposition. But if while doing so, we can also make sure it hits all the hot buttons of Consumer Reports, then obviously we will also do that. And it wasn't just Consumer Reports. I mean, the current generation of GM cars are also designed to please the automotive press, or as Chubachetta told me, instructed me to say the, what is it? Well, he didn't like the term buff boxes. But I think it was a professional media or something like that. But at any rate, if a car gets universally good write-ups, it's obvious. And then most journalists in the hinterlands don't know a thing about steering, braking, cornering, turn-in, and they become heavily influenced by what they read in the expert media. That's the friend of that's what Chubba taught me. Well, expert media.
You know, and GM got 2/3 of the enthusiast car. You did the stick shift Cadillac CTS wagon. If it had a diesel, you would have had the you would have had a home run.
Yeah. Well, there was a case of a car that everybody liked and it didn't sell well.
Seriously, it's an auto journalist car, and it's
Ed Welburn and I loved it.
Well, there you go.
We got one.
See, we're simpatico in that regard, at least.
There is that danger in talking to yourself.
So this means seven were sold?
Yeah. I guess. Okay. Yeah, well, because we couldn't afford any.
You knew this was coming. We've got a Mary Barra question. This is from Dr. Botox. He says, Mary has scant, if any, P&L responsibility in her history. Is this going to come back to haunt her?
No, she knows how to run. She knows how to run stuff, and she's run large organizations like Global Manufacturing Engineering, which she was basically doing while I had Global Product Development. She's got a very sound, logical mind financially. But one of the nice things about her is she is only the second chairman in GM history. The other one having been Bob Stempel. And you know, that didn't work out too well. But she's only the second chairman in GM's history who was not a bean counter. Well, it was always people who could read spreadsheets and balance sheets and P&L statements and figure out all the little errors and inconsistencies. And Mary isn't like that. Mary is predominantly an engineer and a product fanatic. And if you do those two things right, the P&L statement takes care of itself. And obviously she has a chief financial officer in the form of Dan Amen, who, by the way, is also somewhat suspect as a chief financial officer because he's a real car fanatic.
Level 3 license.
Yeah. No, he's a real. But any CEO has to look after the product or the service first, which Mary will superbly. And if she needs any financial counseling, which I doubt that she will, that's what Dan Amen is there for. And I will tell you, it's much easier to get good finance people than it is to get good product people. So I'd always go with the product person. You can always back him or her up with finance people. My forecast is that Mary Barra will do extremely well.
Bob, do you... Mark Royce appears to be delighted that he's not CEO, but that he's global product chief. Do you think, do you have anything to say about that, about Mark Royce?
I think Mark probably, I mean, who wouldn't like being CEO? So I think he's, just like I said when I was made president of Chrysler when Lee Iacocca had the anybody but Lutz plan and wouldn't make me chairman, you know, I put on a brave face and said, this is fine, you know, I'll work well with Bob Eaton and so forth. So you say the right things. Because what are you going to do? Say to the media, I'm really disappointed they should have picked me. Well, I mean,
how's that going to work out for you?
You may as well leave the company at that point.
But and what do you think about him and that job?
I think Mark Rice is an excellent executive. He's one of the purest product guys I've ever known. He's passionate about the product, and Mary did a good job, because everything that's come out in the last 3 to 4 years has been Mary Barra. And unlike when I left Chrysler in 98 and I told everybody, don't screw it up, don't start making them cheaper, you know, don't start the short-term stuff again, I was hardly out of there when it started going downhill. And I was naturally a little bit worried that the same thing would happen at GM, and it didn't. And the focus on excellence and possibly putting, you know, $200 more into the vehicle to take it from a 95% level to a 99.5% level, that didn't stop. And all you do is drive a new CTS or a new Impala or a new Corvette, and you can see that the drive for absolute excellence is alive and well. And it's not going to stop, because Mark Rice won't let it stop, and Mary Barra won't either. And Dan Heyman, the chief financial officer, isn't going to be nickel-timing the product either. So it's almost like, who is going to watch the cost? Now, they'll watch the cost.
I'm sure there's someone there to do that.
Yeah.
Well, it helps when you have all these legacy costs gone, too.
Now we always made a good contribution margin at GM. That wasn't the problem. The problem was we had roughly $30 billion of contribution margin with $40 billion of fixed cost. You know, that didn't work. And now the $40 billion of fixed cost, I don't know what it is right now, but it's a fraction of what it used to be. So GM is keeping the margin. I think the margins on the cars especially have gone up, because like the prior generation LaCrosse had very little margin. The new, and it had to be discounted heavily. The new one sells at much higher prices, so it probably, I have a mental idea of what the margin is, and I would say it's very substantial. So margins have improved, but the number one reason why GM and Chrysler are in good shape now is because, as you point out, that unsupportable burden of interest cost, healthcare expense, et cetera,
bank.
Huh?
The jobs bank.
Oh yeah. Well, that was only $700 million a year. I mean, it sounds like real money to us, yeah. but in the grand scheme of $40 billion,
you could do the whole parking lot with that.
Yeah, yeah.
$40 billion of fixed costs. You know, $700 doesn't look so bad.
Hey, we got a couple of phone calls here, Carmen. Let's bring in one of those. Not ready for the phone call yet. Okay, let me go to one of the other written questions here. Wright Knight says, why didn't you continue the flexible front drive, rear drive platform plan you had at Chrysler when you came to GM? The LH platform idea could have been such a great thing when you were at GM.
Yeah, we started down that road, and that was one of the reasons we used the north-south engine and driveline configuration in the LH cars, because with relatively little modification, we could have run a drive shaft down and a rear diff and everything. But because the configuration was like Audi, an inline north-south engine cantilevered out over the front axle, it probably would have gone all-wheel drive rather than rear-wheel drive. Rear-wheel drive would have required kind of repositioning the front axle and so forth. So it was sort of a dream that we had, but it was never, we never really activated that, and it probably would have been difficult. Again, all-wheel drive would have been easy, but just about every architecture that GM has now is all-wheel drive capable, so why bother?
Here's an interesting one. I hadn't thought of this before. This is JM1NB says, did Bob Lutz have a hand in naming the option package LTZ?
You know, everybody thinks that. Everybody says, oh, well, I got a Suburban Lutz. And I said, what? It says LTZ on it. I guess that's an abbreviation for your name. I said, hey, LTZs were around before I ever joined General Motors. And the last thing I would ever do is have my name or a portion of my name on the product.
As a trim package.
Yeah. I mean, I'd rather have a whole car.
That's but right.
Okay, here's an interesting one. This is from Alexander Karabitsis, if I'm pronouncing that right. Of all the products that you've led development on, which one do you wish you had never brought to production?
Well, actually, probably as sad as it sounds, but it was the original BMW 2002 Turbo with the front spoiler with the mirror image writing where a turbo was written backwards so that people would see it in their rearview mirror. And it had wheel arch extensions, wide wheels, I think a composite hood and this deep front spoiler, as it was the fashion at the time. 240 horsepower, I think, twin cam, intercooled turbo. I mean, it was the world's hottest two-door sedan. Unfortunately, it was launched right at the time of the first 1973 oil embargo. And the German political left was up in arms at saying the automobile industry caused this with their irresponsible horsepower race, and we need speed limits on the Autobahn, and all this fast driving consumes a lot of fuel and it's got to be done away with. Besides, it's killing the forest. That was the precursor to global warming, was that automotive exhausts were killing pine forest. It turned out to be a bark beetle, but it had everybody exercise for a while. So Spiegel magazine and all the media in Germany were down on this car, and it has wretched excess. It was sort of like the same thing that hit the Hummer H2 in the U.S., you know, the symbol of all evil, the automotive antichrist, and what irresponsible person would launch a vehicle like this? And, of course, my boss, von Kuhnheim, said, hey, don't look at me. I mean, that was Mr. Watts's project.
Mr. LTZ's.
Yeah. Could I ask you kind of along these same lines, wonderful idea, the Kappa cars. What happened there? Why didn't it go any further?
Oh.
And I know.
Well, part of the problem was the project was originally supposed to go into Mexico. And low fixed cost, a lot of hand labor, low investment. Saturn Ion and Pontiac Solstice.
So rear drive sports cars.
Oh, they were wonderful. And I still have the Turbo Coupe and a Roadster, and my fiance has a Saturn View, Saturn Ion.
Sky.
Yeah.
Sky Redline. Yeah. Sky Redline. Yeah. So we have three of them in the family and love them. And but it was originally supposed to go to Mexico, and the financial equation worked well because it was going to be in a plant that was properly sized for the 40 to 50,000 that we were going to do. Then a deal was struck with the UAW who granted GM other concessions, but the quid pro quo was we would keep the Wilmington plant open. The Wilmington plant was sized for 300,000 units a year. And we were building 40 to 50,000 Solstices and Skies in that facility just didn't work. So the car had great margins. It was the variable margin on it was between, as I recall, $8,000 or $9,000 a car.
Wow.
But the fixed cost on it just buried it. Mm-hmm. So when we were talking to the feds about the bailout, they wanted to see basically a profit and loss statement on each car. And clearly, the Solstice and Sky didn't make the cut. Besides, this was now the right time to close the Wilmington plant, which we never should have kept for that long in the first place. So Wilmington got closed. Pontiac was dropped. Saturn was dropped. So there was no plant,
No brands.
Yeah. So we would have had to invest a considerable sum of money to move all of the tooling and the assembly fixturing, the assembly line out of Wilmington and put it somewhere else and then rebadge the car. Logic would have meant keep the Sky and make a Chevrolet out of it, mm-hmm. and have a sort of mini Corvette,
right?
Which, you know, has sort of been a dream of mine, but financially, we just couldn't get it done at the time. Mm-hmm. So they were, I think it was a perfectly good car. It was a wonderful car. I can't tell you how much I enjoy driving mine and how good they still look. Mm-hmm. Whether it's the Sky or the Solstice, they're timelessly elegant because they're proportioned so well. But, you know, that's history. It's too bad.
Okay, we do have a couple of phone calls here, and they gave me the sign that they're ready to bring it in. Carmen, let it roll.
And I have two questions for Mr. Lutz. First one, are these VL companies privately held, or will there be stocks available to the public? Are you still involved with Eco Motors? Am I mistaking
you were never involved with Eco Motors.
No. Right. That's my erstwhile GM colleague.
Don Runkel.
Don Runkel, yeah.
But, VL, you're going to take the watch company, the car company public at any point?
Never say never, but for the moment, they're privately held. And we're not seeking outside capital at this point. At some point, you know, we may well, at which point Gilbert and I may become minority owners. But we're not ready for that.
Okay, Carmen, let's bring in the other phone call we've got there.
Hi, John. This is Edward from Denver. I just had more of a general question, I guess. So I wanted to know, does it really cost automakers more money when they build a larger engine, if you will, that is based on the same platform? So kind of like what Ford has, 2-liter and the 2.3-liter EcoBoost. The reason I'm asking is I recently saw your show about the Jeep Grand Cherokee, and I saw that they went from the 3.6-liter. They actually designed a whole new 3.2-liter V6. And is that something they did just, you know, to save some money, or is it actually something just for fuel and they really don't actually save anything? Thank you. Love the show.
Yeah, thanks. If you take a V6 engine and go from a 3.7 to a 3.3, you don't save any money doing that.
Well, if it's a new engine, you don't. Or if it's a new engine and you design a new lighter weight, more compact, thinner wall, engine around that 3.3 volume, yeah, then you'll take cost and weight out. But if you take the same block and head as on your 3.6 and you just underbore it or understroke it to take it from 3.6 down to 3.3, you save nothing. But sometimes a manufacturer will do it anyway in order to justify a lower price point. Or justify the same price point, but now the customer only gets a 3.3, and to get the 3.6, it says, oh, I'm sorry, sir, that's now an extra cost option. So varying engine sizes are going up in engine size is a prime way that the automobile industry globally makes more money per car. Mm. And the cost difference between the various small blocks that are offered, the cost difference, unless you get to the LS9, which is a very expensive engine. But the others, the cost ramp is very flat, but the pricing ramp is very steep.
That's why you saw so much of that American cars in the 1960s, right? I mean, the price to the consumer was, you know, you could get a big block engine for $90 or $100 more than the base engine in many cases, and they offered so many of those because they made extra money out of it.
But it comes back to what you said earlier in the show, is it's what people want.
Yeah.
And if you want more power, you got to pay for it.
Yeah, sure.
Even if it's really no extra cost.
Right.
Hey, we need to wrap this show up, but we can't leave yet without asking you about your book that you've got here, Icons and Idiots. And
well, what can I say? It's my latest book, and it's straight talk on leadership. And it basically, each chapter is devoted to one of the leaders in my life that made a difference on the positive or negative or mixed side. And then it's got Lee Iacocca, Red Poling, Phil Caldwell, and many others, including my Marine Corps drill instructor and my high school teacher in Switzerland, whom I greatly admired. And here I was, you know, 20 years old. I graduated from high school very late due to academic performance problems. But
is that
really,
only academic?
Yeah, well, it was general problems. We won't restrict it to academia. But at any rate, this teacher impressed me profoundly, and I always thought, this guy is such a brilliant leader and so well-rounded and has such an in-depth knowledge of politics, history, et cetera, et cetera, author of many books. How can this guy be only a high school teacher? And, you know, 6 or 7 years later, he was president of Switzerland. So quite a remarkable person. So all that's in the book. I guarantee to anybody, it's a fun read. Lots of funny anecdotes, and I aim to amuse as I inform.
I've read the book. I love it. I learned things out of it. I highly recommend anybody in the business, or even if you're not in the business, to read it.
Yeah, this is maybe the first of my three books that's a general treatise on leadership do's and don'ts, and it's not specific to the automobile business.
And as I told you before, you can't overlook Car Guys versus Bean Counters, which I think is a better book than that one. I mean, that's a good book, but that's that.
Well, I'm happy if they buy that too.
It's no, I mean, it's a great book.
Thank you.
Well, Bob Lutz, thanks so much for coming on Autoline After Hours. You're welcome here anytime. It's been
always
great
fun.
Talking with you.
Always fun. Thanks very much.
Todd Lasso, great having you here as well. Thanks for being on the show.
And John, always a pleasure. Thank you.
And Gary, great, man, my new co-host. It's great to have you here.
Thanks, John.
I want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.